This is Vaughn Stewart, still sore from the spanking I took out at the Technology Woodshed, saying, you're Bush League if you're not listening to the Virtually Speaking podcast.
Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're going to learn today.
Innovate like a startup. Deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeed up and ready because it's going to be a great day.
I know you're going to dig this.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Aero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 8. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Aero, and joining me as always is your friend and mine, Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, man?
Pete, I'm exhausted. It's been a long week.
Yeah, it is. We are coming to you live from, or pseudo-live, because I guess I'm pre-recording this, but we are coming to you from Austin, Texas. I got to tell you, this is my first time in Austin, and I am loving it.
It's hard to describe just how awesome it is here, but what really makes it are the people. There's some great people here.
Yeah, on that note, we spent the week here visiting some of our brothers and sisters at VMware. VMware has a pretty good presence here. But we also had the opportunity to attend the Austin VMUG this week. And so I'm excited to share some of the conversations that we captured from both customers, VMware employees, and also some of our cool partners. But before we dive into that, I want to introduce some of our teammates that are sitting in on the podcast with us. Both of these guys have been on the podcast before, so no strangers. First sitting next to me is GS Khalsa. GS, how you doing, man?
I am, like John, beat. It has been a long week.
Yeah, it's been a long week, and you're about to get on a plane.
Yeah, I got to fly home and then take care of the kids all weekend. So, yeah, I am kind of done.
Your work is never done. Sitting next to you is the third man on the Virtual SAN TM team, Mr. Jeff Hunter. Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
Pete, thanks. Good to be here. Like John and GS, I'm a little worn out too, but it's a good worn out. This is a great city. We had some good food down here. We visited 6th Street a little bit, and I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. And we'll never talk about everything that happened on 6th Street, but it was a good time, absolutely. So, John, the first clip I want to play is a conversation we had with Pure Storage's Vaughn Stewart. He co-presented with Rawlinson Rivera for the keynote, and so take a listen. All right, well, joining us straight from the woodshed here at the VMUG is Vaughn Stewart. Vaughn, how you doing, sir?
Hey, Pete, it's great to be on the podcast. How are you, mate?
Very good, very good. John, did you get a chance to see the keynote this morning with Pure and Virtual SAN himself, Mr. Rawlinson?
Yeah, it was great getting a bit of that. And I love the part where you almost described everyone's a victim. The storage industry is a victim of its own obsession with IOPS at this point. It's almost like we're at that point of ridiculousness where, oh, yeah, my platform will do 40.6 million IOPS. We need to talk more on latency. We need to talk about results because fundamentally that's what drives the end user computing experience is latency.
Well, for those who weren't able to catch it, Vaughn, why don't you give us the recap? What were you guys talking about today?
What a great day at the Austin VMUG. Always a privilege when you get a chance to speak at a user con.
Yes.
Never take it lightly if you're a vendor. I was unable to make it last year. I'm here this year. There are a lot of other user cons I would love to make it to that I just, for some reason, can't. So apologies in advance to Charles Goutreau down in Charlotte. One more year of not being there. With that said, this year we had two sessions I was a part of. First was a joint keynote with Rawlinson Rivera. So we helped open the day. And we had one of those multi-vendor, industry-neutral, vendor-neutral conversations around the intersection of storage, virtualization, private cloud automation. Absolutely loved it, right? The kind of the key theme that we talked about during the keynote is this growing trend towards VMware admins becoming storage admins, what I call the convergence of the storage and the server team, right? VMware long said, storage, server, networking teams would all merge. The networking guys are still kind of out on their own right now. Great session, though. We talked about how technologies like hyper-converged and even all-flash storage units like top-of-rack storage designs are moving into the VSI and VDI space, and not just with the small and mid-sized customers. We're seeing this in the enterprise. It's not as pervasive yet, but it's growing. And you know what? The storage teams, the old school storage guys, they're okay with it. They realize that they have given, maybe under-delivered the level of services that the VMware team has been asking for a number of years. And they're kind of like, oh, we can coexist. So that was good. you know, that was good. We shared some technologies there around data reductions, with some technologies around defining, you know, service policies and making an automation engine through vRealize Automation, which, by the way, is my favorite new VMware technology of the last 5 years. Finally, private cloud is here.
Yes. So SCSI Unmap, a favorite feature of mine that was originally launched in 5.0 to a lot of fanfare and then quickly discovered to break a lot of arrays. It was moved to an asynchronous model for reclaiming. What this is, if you delete a VMDK on a data store, what this technology allows you to do is run a script and basically, you know, run a CLI command and pull data back. Now, the other question is about running Unmap and then the guest. So if you're in a typical file system, you know, this is a concern of if you delete stuff in the guest, the space doesn't show back up on the data store. So I heard you had some information about this.
Yeah, so John, so great point. A couple years back in the 5.5 days, we'd stumbled on, if you played around in the inner workings of vSphere, you could make guest level VM Unmap work. And we were blown away because we had done some research that showed roughly 40 to 50% of the storage capacity that sits on customers' storage arrays or storage layers for VMware, particularly like aged virtual server environments, is data that was deleted, whether it was deleted seconds ago, months ago, or years ago.
Did you say aged? I'm imagining like fine crafted cheeses here. Like
yeah.
This is an aged VM. It's kind of like my artisanal handcrafted vCenter. No automation, you know, used for creating.
Yes, this is 2011. This is a good year.
This is my SQL Server 2012. What a vintage year for relational databases. all kidding aside, so with vSphere 6, a new feature that I think has kind of flown under the radar is the ability of VM level unmap. And look, we can go into this in a lot of detail. I should get a blog out that explains this in greater detail than what I've seen today. And so how about I do this? Within 48 hours of this podcast, those who go to VaughnStewart.com or the old virtualstorageguy.com can see some detail on this. Bottom line, regardless of the storage platform you have, regardless whether you're using data reduction or not, etc., Unmap will remove roughly anywhere from 25 to 50% of your raw storage capacity needs immediately.
That is huge. And I never knew it was that much. 40% of data just sitting out there of just deleted files. That's just unacceptable.
Well, and when you think about it, like NTFS and these file systems, they were never thin friendly. They always wrote into new space. So as you deleted data, now VMFS is thin friendly. If you delete something, it will write back into space. But like I saw a breakdown of like the 14 major file systems, and over half of them are wildly thin unfriendly. They will always write into new space, and this was around trying to, you know, optimize and for recoverability, VSS, things like that, you know, trying to preserve that data in NTFS's case as long as possible. They always write a new space. So anytime you delete something, you're just going to keep writing in until you eventually expand that thin VMDK, and then it's the equivalent of a fully hydrated VMDK.
Yeah, it's funny. For over a decade, the storage industry's kind of been like, woohoo, thin provisioning, you know, consume on demand. And there's value there. I've kind of always felt like the oddball going like, well, when do I get the space back? Like, it just seems like it always grows and grows and grows, even if I delete.
I always thought that was like a scam by the storage industry of like, yeah, thin provision it all, and then, oh, wait, you're running up against the edge and you deleted things and get... Sorry, you gotta buy another shelf. No, I mean there's the woodshed conversation. Like, you know, I felt that, and there were platforms out there that had no type of reclaiming. Sometimes we'd hack at it, we'd write zeros and use compression or dedupe, which was a hack, and it has metadata overhead, as I think you and I discussed. But you know, without having any type of in-place reclaim, thin provisioning fundamentally was a dangerous technology. You were writing checks for future storage purchases that you weren't necessarily going to claim.
I would venture to say that not having that reclaim in there would almost be bush league.
I've got nothing to add to that. No comment.
All right, Vaughn, we really appreciate your time, man. And how can people get in touch with you?
So, look, I'm available online at vstude on the Twitters, vaughnstewart.com online. Look, we shared some great stuff at the keynote here today at the VMUG. We also had a great breakout session where we covered new flash array, like the M10, which is available to customers at under $50,000. The Flash Blade, which was announced at our Accelerate conference. So
right.
Pure getting into the, you know, massive scale out object in NAS space for under a dollar, you know, usable gigabyte. Not to make this an ad, if you want to know more about that, head over to my blog or purestorage.com.
Excellent. Well, we definitely want to get you on the podcast once we're back in the office and maybe do a deep dive on what Pure is doing these days.
That would be awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
That was great. That's the real woodshed conversation. That's hilarious. Well, yeah, we'll be sure to put a link on the notes page of the blog that Vaughn is promising. And if it's not there, we will publicly shame him on Twitter.
Shame, shame.
So we also had a chance to grab Rollins and Rivera and talk a little bit about what he's up to. As I mentioned, he co-presented with Vaughn on the keynote, and so here's what he had to say.
You know, Vaughn and I have been working together for a very long time. You know, I was a year or so ago, I was asked to join the Vaughn and Chad show at VMworld, right when we released vSAN, I believe, and it was pretty good. And ever since then, we've been collaborating, hosting sort of games at VMworld, and now Vaughn and I are going to take the show on the road, as they say. We have a session, we're going to co-present throughout the VMUG circuit, delivering the greatness and the goodies of Flash technologies and some vSphere related specifics that our customers and everyone kind of getting into the new and evolving world of Flash and storage technologies should know about, and not necessarily targeting specific products, right? We still talk about what virtual SAN does. We talk about what, you know, Pure Storage is able to do as an example of the changes in the evolution of storage and Flash technology.
I know you see some of the crazy and cool environments, and you talk to some customers who are really pushing the limits. Specific to vVols and vSAN, can you give us some examples of what you've seen?
I got to tell you that I've been privy to some pretty incredible information on the vSAN front. I don't want to blow it out because I want to save it for VMworld, but let me tell you, I've seen some very, very unique designs, device manufacturing, and use cases which will be revealed, approved legally and everything at VMworld. That's on the vSAN spectrum. On virtual volumes, you better believe it that the second coming is here. The framework will get a couple of things that was missing before, which will make it a lot better for everybody else. Now people will start doing some of the things they wanted to do with their arrays, like some of these awesome replication things, leveraging our policy framework, which is the greatest thing ever created, period. It's the control plane for IT folks, whether it's virtual volumes, virtual SAN, NFS, VMFS. We can all make it work exactly the same and operate it exactly the same. If you don't believe me, I got the demos to prove it.
Oh yeah.
Holler at me.
Wow, wow. You know, I need SPBM for the rest of my life now. Like, I was booking plane tickets last night. I mean, this is too complicated. We need some policies. I can just do some drop downs. Like, you know, I need SPBM for my Uber. Like, you know, make sure it's automatically, you know, going to be waiting. Like, they, you know, some quality of service guarantees that Uber will pick me up within 2 minutes. We need SPBM for everything.
All right, Rollo. Well, I wasn't going to let you do this, but I think that was worthy of it. Go ahead and drop my mic.
For real? It broke.
Oh, that was a lot of fun. Yeah, he's quite the character with his breaking mics, but fortunately my mic didn't break, so. So, John, you know Rollinson pretty well. What do you think he's talking about? He seemed to put a big vSAN teaser there.
He's got some things cooking. He's I think, you know, legally binding. I can't say what he's up to, but we've got big plans. Also, I'd also like to speak on behalf of Microphones Everywhere and say no part of this podcast endorses the destruction of audio equipment.
Well said, well said. All right, so the next one we spoke to was a customer, also a vExpert, really, really, really sharp guy who happens to look exactly like Keanu Reeves. I mean, that dude, it tripped me out. I saw his Twitter picture, and it was Keanu Reeves, and I thought, why does this guy have a picture of Keanu Reeves on his profile? But then when I saw him, then I thought, maybe that picture wasn't Keanu Reeves, because this guy looks just like Keanu Reeves. His name is Marcus Puckett, and here's what he had to say at the VMUG.
So hands down, the best sessions that I went to at the last VMworld are the Ask the Expert panels. They're really small sessions where you get to interact directly with, you know, VMware's engineering, their high-level people, and you get really deep dives, you get all the information that they're not going to talk about at the public, you know, 1,000-plus person attendance sessions. Those sessions are far and away the most informative and best sessions.
So Marcus, if Pete and I hosted a session called Snapshots Suck, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much would you want to be there for that session?
That would be my number one session. I can't begin to explain how much snapshots actually suck.
All right. I think we need to get a new soundbite. We need to have everybody do the snapshots suck. So you're at the VMUG here in Austin, Texas. Have you any takeaways so far? Any interesting conversations with either customers or vendors?
So the lunchtime keynote was about evolving your IT career, and it had the tagline of, if you don't like change, you'll like being irrelevant even more. And it's definitely, if people aren't already trying to change how they do things via automation, Maybe not necessarily containers, just depends on the use case, but you know, trying to update, have infrastructure as code, use software as a service, use public and private cloud models. You really need to reevaluate the value that you bring to the business that you work for, because you're going to quickly find yourself irrelevant if you don't.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting how he brought up the point that your LinkedIn profile is probably already outdated because nobody's looking for a virtual administrator anymore or a storage administrator so much as they're looking for a cloud architect or you know, there are a lot of terms that are changing for sure.
Yeah, and it's really true. Like, it used to be, you know, highly around silos, the ITIL world, which maybe that can be another soundbite, ITIL sucks. But no, I mean, the highly siloed skill set era, there's still some places for that, but it's a smaller and smaller, you know, it's kind of like being a storage guy at this point. If that's all you do, you're that gray beard in the corner cursing at, you know, fiber channel buffers, and everyone else is like, huh, like I'm using Object. I just, SPBM, this stuff's all automated. But no, it's, and it, at the same time though, you know, that new architect, everybody has to know a little networking. You know, I'm doing some training tomorrow on networking tomorrow, because everyone who works with vSAN needs to know some networking. Everyone who works with VMware needs to know. Network admins need to understand that there's a reason there's 70 MAC addresses behind that port. Yes, there's more than one server, Virginia, behind that port. So I've had lots of awkward conversations where people realize there's this entire other world once you move to the next wire in the infrastructure. And that's something that, you know, these cloud automation, these new skill sets, you've got to be able to think like, you know, an economist, you got to be able to speak like an accountant, and you got to be able to act like an architect is really the path forward in terms of being that new infrastructure ninja.
Yep, I thought that was good. I also like the fact that he said when they interview people for their company, they check things like, do they have a GitHub account? You know, like, what are these guys doing? You know, they're always learning. You can't just stick to one thing, storage, or just being the VI admin. It's not that kind of world anymore. The only thing I didn't like about his session was the fact that he recommended everybody listen to technical podcasts.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a bunch of examples on there, and I didn't see the Virtually Speaking podcast on there.
I almost said, I didn't want to call from the peanut gallery too much, but I was thinking about saying, hey, what about Virtually Speaking, guys?
Exactly. All right, Marcus, we appreciate your time, man. Enjoy the rest of your time at the VMUG.
Thanks. Good to be on the podcast and meet everybody.
Yeah, Marcus, good guy. So I guess we're going to see if we're going to do that session on Snapshot Suck. I think that would be fun. I mean, obviously, we don't think all snapshots suck, but that's the whole point of the session is to tease you with a statement like that and then tell you all the goodness.
Yeah, one of the things that I heard at the show, and it's been coming up somewhat often enough that I feel like I need to dispel it, is a lot of people think that with vSphere replication that by default it uses snapshots, and it actually doesn't. It's vSphere replication has this own proprietary technology that it uses, a lightweight delta that it uses for tracking those changes and getting those across to the other side. It does. There is one time where it uses snapshots, and that's if you're using VSS QSing. But otherwise, lightweight deltas, no snapshots, and you're good to go.
I didn't know that. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, one of the things just being at the VMUG and spending time this week with the team was I just find part of why my brain hurts is being in IT, and I think this is what Tommy in his lunchtime keynote was trying to emphasize too, is you're always learning. If you're not learning, you're going backwards. So.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, Pete, you know what was refreshing about the lunch session too is it was not a sales pitch. You know, a lot of times we go to events like this and yeah, you know, at some point it's an education type thing and inevitably sales will get wrapped into that conversation. But, you know, it's nice to see a presentation that just talks about the industry, right, or trends or something along that line. It has nothing to do with a sales pitch or a product or anything like that. So believe it or not, I would vote that as probably the top session I sat in on at this VMUG event.
Wow. Nice. High praise. So we also got a chance to grab the product manager for Virtual SAN, Vahid, and he had a couple of really cool things to say as well. All right, I'm sitting here with Vahid Faradoni, right? I pronounced that right?
Sounds good.
Close
That's
enough.
A great try.
Yeah, Vahid Faradoni is actually the product manager for Virtual SAN, and so you're here at the VMUG. I'd love to hear what some of your takeaways are.
Yeah, first of all, I love Austin. It's such a great city, and we kind of went to the VMUG today. It's always awesome to see all this great energy and all these customers and partners who are coming to this event. It's always amazing. It was a great session on vSAN. Overall, there was a lot of kind of positive feedback. Also, in hallway conversations I had with customers, all the new enhancements we made in the product is resonating very well with our customer base. Overall, we are investing heavily on the R&D side, as you know, on vSAN, and we are happy that it's actually working, and our customers actually appreciate this, and we are sure that we're going to see more and more adoption of our product, and we're going to continue our leadership in HCI market. There are a couple of other partners. Actually, I went to their sessions, which was interesting to me. I think Tintree, for example, have a very good story in terms of quality of service and some of the VM awareness they have that's kind of also aligned with some of the stuff we are doing on the vSAN side with SPBM and our VM-centric kind of story. The other thing, actually, I went to a demo of Cohesity, and I love their UI, the work they're doing.
Yeah.
The kind of overall user experience was very interesting to me.
Yeah, that whole concept of secondary storage, we got a chance to talk to Nick Howell, one of their main tech evangelists, and he shared a lot about that with us. We're going to play that clip later on in the podcast.
Yeah, that was a great conversation because, you know, it's interesting seeing for the past 6 months, I've been focused a lot on the various engineering decisions we made, you know, global dedupe versus, you know, that, you know, variable block versus fixed, nearline versus post. And it's really interesting talking to the guys in secondary storage because it's a completely different, you know, set of things you do, and they're right for that market. So it's interesting seeing, you know, different vendors finding different places within the ecosystem, and that's the great thing about working at VMware is not only do we have our own great products, but we've got a lot of great partners and a lot of great solutions within the marketplace.
So did you get a chance to ask anybody any questions about what they're doing with vSAN, what they want to see, any takeaways?
Yeah, I talked to several customers who are using vSAN. We have a lot of customers who actually are using it for remote office branch offices, VDI, and we have many customers, actually I talked to several as well, that they're running, for example, their SQL or Exchange or Oracle on vSAN. Overall, customers are kind of seeing, once they start, typically a lot of our customers start kind of small, going with Robo or VDI kind of use cases, but then once they see the benefits in terms of availability and performance, immediately they go and turn around and then start deploying their business critical applications on vSAN, which makes us very happy, actually. That's what, from the beginning, that was our principle of architecting vSAN in terms of scale and performance, and that's what we are seeing, right? And the other thing is we have already a lot of reference architectures for business-critical applications like Exchange, SQL, Oracle, and some of the, like, SAP, for example, is in progress. And, you know, a lot of our customers appreciate that, and we are happy that, you know, everybody's adopting the product, and overall it's a very, very positive feedback. And we are constantly getting feedback from customers to enhance our overall product and provide a better user experience as well. And the other thing I just want to mention lastly is some of the stuff we've done on the management side has been very, very impressive, and that's the feedback we get from our customer base. Also, we have some customers who are like love APIs and SDK stuff.
Oh, yeah.
All of that is available now. So for the folks who are very hands-on and they love to play with the products through command line and maybe do a very large-scale deployment, it's all available now.
That's beautiful. All right, Vahid, I hope you enjoy the rest of your time in Austin, and thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
All right, yeah, that was awesome. I really like Vahid. He's, you know, he's one of those product managers that we talk about that, you know, it's cool being at a company where product managers are actually really smart. You know, they know the business side, but they also dive into the weeds and actually get really technical, and he's one of those. He's also, I love the fact, I was in a couple of sessions with him, and it's always funny because he'll hijack a session and be like asking questions. How many of you are using this, and how many people think this? And he's working while he's here. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, he is ready to answer questions and be like, no, this is how this works, or why do you want to do that? You know, there's a lot of, wait, is there a feature opportunity? You know, is there an extension of the platform we need to make? So he's not just on this release and the next, he's also looking out for the future.
Yeah, the other funny part for me was Rawlinson was in the front row, and somebody asked a question, and Rawlinson started like going into futures. He didn't get too much, but I just looked over. I looked over to Vahid like, I don't know if he's really enjoying that. Yeah, and so the last part that we have for you is a conversation that we had with Cohesity. Vahid had also mentioned that he spoke to them about, you know, some of what they're doing with secondary storage. It's a pretty interesting solution that they've got going on, and so we're going to share that with you now. All right, well, joining us now in the Austin VMUG is no stranger to the podcast and a good friend of mine at Cohesity, Mr. Nick Howell, Data Center Dude. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing fantastic, Mr. Fletcher.
So I saw you at your booth chatting with some of your customers. You guys have a pretty interesting story over there. It's not something that I've seen a lot of other vendors do, John. It's something that the title really caught my eye. It's secondary storage. Have you ever heard of secondary storage before?
I mean, I have some vague ideas like backup targets or like VTLs,
right?
Things was kind of my thought, but the whole concept of secondary storage is kind of interesting because everyone's fighting for primary storage. Everyone's like, oh yeah, we're the fastest, we're the biggest, we'll scale to your biggest, baddest workload. You got a 300 terabyte, you know, SAP LUN that needs 12.6 million IOPS. We got you covered.
Yeah.
But no one's saying, hey, give us your slow. Give us, you know, the junk drawer, so to speak. Give us everything else. Give us your backups and, you know, all your other stuff. that's something that, you know, to a certain degree, nothing's really exciting happened in a couple years. It's been kind of the same vendors kind of evolving, getting a little bigger, and trying to do something in some type of holistic package. It's intriguing. I want to know more.
Excellent. Well, you absolutely nailed it. I mean, we use the old iceberg analogy that Data Domain used, and there's been people before it, but it still holds water. But you're exactly right. Primary storage is what you hear all the hype about. All the media is talking about all flash and who's got the fastest dragster and IOPS and SPC1 reports and all of those things, right? But we've forgotten about all the little guys. Like you called it the junk drawer. And I think that's a fun analogy in a sense because it is kind of, use it as everything else. It's everything else except for all that stuff that you hear about. So this is all the things like your backups, your archives, your file shares, any kind of test and dev environments, and even now cloud integrations, right? This has all come into play. And the funny part about this, we actually did a survey and we found that upwards of 80% of a typical data center footprint is comprised of these secondary items. The problem here is it's just ridiculously fragmented across all of these different vendors and solutions and licensing models and all of this stuff, right? You have to maintain it every year from an OpEx perspective. And the analyst community has even clocked in and started referring to this as dark data.
Yeah, so I really love that term. So a fun game I used to play with customers who were saying they needed to buy more storage was there's an obscure role in Windows file services that no one realizes they're called File Server Resource Manager, FSRM. And I would turn on reports and I would say, give me your top 100 files by size, your top files by user, your top files by file type. I want a special report for media files. And you would always end up finding like, okay, we've got a bunch of Disney movies. We've got backups of backups. Yeah. Some guy named Bob is apparently using 60% of the file server, and I don't know why.
It's MP3.
Yeah, the giant. Well, sometimes it was valuable data, but it was lower value data. It wasn't necessarily worth, keeping there. And it's like, okay, why is this stuff on a tier one storage platform? Some of the stuff maybe needed to not be there, and that's a question about actually looking at data and analytics and aging and ILM and things like that, the lost art of data management. But that I love that term dark data. Like that's hopefully you guys don't have a trademark on that, so we'll be talking about that more.
No, there's actually several different kind of definitions of it. It can be anything from data that's just lost on endpoints, shadow IT kind of scenarios, if you think of those, where people are taking data out and putting it onto their desktops. It's at risk, right? There's a case around like zombie snapshots, where you break the chain and it just sits out there consuming space. And then there's the other case of just test and dev environments that you have provisioned out 6 months ago, but you don't know where they are or who owns them, right?
Sure.
So all of this is part of kind of that dark data umbrella. And we've really just lost track of a lot of this stuff. As we've all been busy virtualizing and getting our all-flash arrays or our primary solutions, we've just forgotten about these little guys. And like to your point, I mean, I consider Data Domain to be the last real innovation in data protection. You call out, there's been some advancements and add-ons from some of the incumbent vendors, sure. But, I mean, Data Domain doing inline deduplication was probably the last big one. That was 10 years ago. Probably even longer than that. The acquisition was about 10 years ago, right? So that's where we look at this. But what if we could take, I like playing this hypothetical game, what if we could take some of the benefits we've learned from hyperconvergence, the node-based architecture styles,
okay,
and apply some of the, the data physics of object storage and the indexing and the metadata management and things like that. Combine those two into this distributed scale-out, shared nothing platform, right? That's what we're doing here, and that's what we're calling hyper-converged secondary storage.
So to make sure I understand this, what you're doing is you're basically, to a certain degree, a lot of times people have places where they are storing that backup data or that DR site or that DR copy, and you end up having to, you have a lot of, in order to have that many disks, you end up with CPU and memory that's sitting around there doing nothing, and you're leveraging that compute, which is compute's gotten a lot cheap, that's attached to that secondary storage since you're using an HCI scale-out type approach for it to do all these other services in terms of either, be it data reduction or indexing or get some intel and information out of it.
Totally.
Fancy.
I mean, well, I said the word platform a couple of times back there. It is hardware, it is software. It's a combination of both. If you're familiar with Nutanix, it's a similar kind of node-based architecture. It's a 2U chassis. It's got four nodes in each of the chassis. And each of those nodes, from a hardware perspective, I mean, you're talking about some horsepower, right? There's 12 drives across the four nodes within that 2U chassis, but each node has two Intel 8-core Haswells, and it comes with 64 gigs of RAM. that's expandable to 256 per node. So maxed out, you could be looking at something that had gave you 100 terabytes of raw capacity, 6.5 terabytes of PCI MLC flash. What is that? Four times, eight core Haswells and a terabyte of RAM.
Wow, that's pretty bad.
So find me a storage array that does that in 2U and I'll shake your hand.
That's, hey, I say being on the vSAN team here, like, HCI, it is crazy what you can get in these small packages with these four nodes and two rack units. I mean, it's, you know, to a certain degree, I'm like, why would we ever buy blades again for density? Because, I mean, you, when you're just like, I can get two, you know, you can, some of these platforms, you get up to like 2 terabytes and two, you have like a terabyte of RAM per rack unit. It's like, I'm going to melt a hole in the floor with that many DEMs. Like, no, I mean, legitimately cooling and power becoming, it's crazy what these new dense form factors offer. And it's interesting seeing someone do something besides just run VMs on it, not just to demean what we do here at VMware, but in what everyone else is doing with it. But it's interesting to see these platforms, this hardware platform, get used in kind of an innovative way.
Well, it's interesting you bring up it's a great segue into kind of the story, because a lot of people ask us, or they get the rock eyebrow, the raised eyebrow around, wow, you've got a lot of horsepower in there with so little disk. Like, what's going on with that? Well, when you go down the story of what we're actually replacing, it becomes necessary for several reasons. One, a lot of the back-end processes like deduplication, metadata processing, and things like that, keeping track of all those indices and whatnot. But when you have a primary set of workloads, whether that's virtual infrastructure, physical servers, databases, et cetera, they're going to be running on some kind of primary storage. It's, you know, let's say a all-flash array or an instance of vSAN, right? One of those kinds of things, right? That needs to be protected at some point. So you're going to leverage a Commvault or a NetBackup or any of the other kind of incumbent backup guys, and that's going to be a media server, and you're probably going to have a catalog that's got the global repository in it off somewhere. And then you're going to need a piece of target storage, like a data domain, to ship that off to, maybe a NetApp file or something along those lines to send that stuff off to. But the more workloads you add to this, more of these third-party, you know, I call it extraneous infrastructure to an extent. Everything has a license and a support contract and different models and UIs and all the stuff you have to manage and do. That's just data protection. We're not even talking about replication and all of those kinds of things yet. So within the confines of secondary storage, then we start talking about tier two NAS, file shares, right? People's home drives and whatnot. Test and dev environments that are likely additional copies that are sitting out on some additional piece of storage. And now we're dealing with these things called cloud gateways that are yet another piece of extraneous infrastructure that sit in there, and they're licensed and support all that stuff just to ship data off to the cloud. This is the chaos that we're really addressing. And it's been like this since the late 90s. We've just continued to bolt on in a whack-a-mole fashion the way that we solve these things.
And one other thing is there are other people who try to combine some of these functions into the primary platform. And not to say that's necessarily a bad idea, but from a business and operational side, when you want to change your tier one platform, if it's also your cloud gateway, if it's also your backup management system that's tied to your compliance retention, you can't just, it used to be, you know, your tier one, you can throw it out, put a new one in, storage motion over, done. But if you've got a 7-year retention policy and that system is also your archive and that's your, you know, it's also your backups for your compliance reasons, and it managed the data placement in the cloud gateway, so its format is fundamentally something that has to be maintained. You now are basically stuck with that platform and whatever its support renewals are till the end of time. This is a much, backup has always been a much stickier side of, it's been always, you know, because rehydrating that data and migrating something else is something that really no sane person wants to do. So separating out your tier two that has all this from your tier one gives you some operational flexibility. And to a certain degree, since a lot of the tier one data services, you know, are either being extended by vVols or in some cases, you know, like vSAN, we're moving them into the hypervisor, and some just like storage vMotion, copy management have already done that. Separating out your tier two services in a flexible way, that should give you a lot more leverage, so to speak, when negotiating and figuring out what you're going to do for your primary storage.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the way that we approach this is, you know, it goes in steps. We don't want to go in and just rip out your entire backup infrastructure and replace it with everything. So we can be used as a target. A scale-out target is what we refer to it as. And it's essentially you go in and you replace what you've been using as a target in the past with something that is this more hyper-converged friendly or hyper-converged platform, but scale-out friendly, so that as you grow, you just continue to build nodes on top of it rather than adding a net new device every single time you fill the previous one up, right? This gives us that kind of flexibility. So if you're a huge fanboy for Veeam or NetBackup or Commvault or any of those other solutions that are out there, continue to use them. We can present USMB and NFS the same way the other guys do, but give you a more elegant target solution than what we've had in the past.
And I love that scale out. You know, let's avoid the forklift, which as much as everyone I've heard today and just recently been talking about avoiding forklifts, and that's, you know, a reason for scale out. I just imagine there's these, you know, drunken forklift drivers roaming the data centers. Like, I mean, it's, you know, it's, I always have to like clarify. No. You know, actually, someone asked me like, wait, there's forklifts in the data center? I was like, no. Beep, beep, beep. No. But it's, you know, the concept of the forklift is you reach the maximum capacity of a device and you have to rip it out and do that. And the great thing about the scale-out architecture of taking this approach is you just add another node. You add another node, you scale, you know, just keep doing that. But although I did actually have a friend who worked for a very large bank, a top, you know, five big shop, and they actually did have that happen one time. Someone legitimately used a forklift and just picked up the wrong rack because they were moving gear around, and they decommissioned a rack and ran off with a forklift, and there was an accident. I think they had some data loss. So
was it a Z890 mainframe?
I was about to say, if something wide enough, I mean, it's probably not a standard rack. That's probably like an old frame system. But
yeah, the only problem is now we've got all these forklift drivers that are out of work.
Right. Well, you know, there's plenty of jobs at Lowe's and Home Depot. So,
there you go.
You know, it's fine. But we kind of don't stop there. So this continues to get more and more elegant because we are a platform. We laid the foundation first to do a lot of this stuff and manage the scale-out nature of it. But wait, there's more. We also built in some backup orchestration software. And it is all policy-driven. So basically, we connect everything through VADP or natively to instances of your databases, pull that inventory, you know, the representation of it into our UI and give you a series of checkboxes that you can build a profile around whatever data set you want to keep and apply a policy to that. And that policy is going to dictate, you know, RTO, RPO kind of metrics around local snaps versus maybe you keep locals for 30 days and you keep replica copies offsite for a year, and then maybe anything older than a year you can shuttle up to the cloud. All of that stuff is completely policy driven in a set it and forget it sort of way.
Nice. So you can use your own backup software if you choose, or you actually can use the Cohesity backup software.
Absolutely. We give you the option to do either one.
Nice.
So one other question. Do you do any orchestration of snapshots on the primary data for checkpoints on data in place? So in terms of like automating either VM snaps, calling API, and keeping those as part of a workflow, or like if you had like a NetApp or traditional array, do you do any type of source, I mean, the primary data, managing that as part of the workflow?
You're talking about like snapshot offload to us in a sense.
Yeah, so you would trigger the snapshots on the primary and track what those checkpoints were, and then from your UI, if it's like super, generally for the really low RPO stuff, and then at that stuff where you don't even want to waste time on the data movement, you could trigger that. Because I know, I think Commvault does that. I've seen that in some cases. It's just a weird thing. I was curious if you did it.
There's a no and a not yet answer to this. Okay. So everybody's heard that we've recently partnered with Pure Storage. There is some engineering effort that's taking place to do some of that kind of snapshot offload. You'll see, you know, us start appearing in each other's UI at some point, maybe to do a lot of this orchestration within Purity, which is their interface, right? But to directly, we want to stay completely agnostic to whatever your primary storage is, not for 99% of the use cases. We pull everything through vCenter, so completely regardless of what you're doing underneath the covers. We do leverage VMware snapshots for the VM consistency if you choose to. It's a little toggle on your data protection profile if you want to use that. But the general answer to your question is no, and it's because we don't want to affect production side that much.
That's fair.
So if we continue this story down this yellow brick road, right, we've now covered integrated data protection. We've gone from a scale-out target. We've eliminated a lot of extraneous infrastructure and software and licensing and stuff. And what we found with a lot of customers is that kind of pays for their investment in Cohesity as a platform just by eliminating that annual spend that they have to go through, right? But now that we've got all of that stuff on the box, now we can collapse all of these other workflows like your test and dev. We can take those backups, spin them up as fully hydrated clones directly on the Cohesity box, again, without affecting your primary side at all. From a recovery standpoint, we execute almost the exact same workflow, allow you to customize it, network, data store, etc. And we stand it up on the box, our Cohesity box here as well. If you want to put that in production, you're happy with it, just storage vMotion it live back across to the primary side, right? It's very, very simple the way the recoveries and stuff like that works.
So you have a pretty much the same features that most storage vendors have in terms of doing rapid cloning and all other derivatives like snapshots that are actually built into this secondary appliance?
Absolutely. And we so what you would expect to find on most, you know, $500,000 controller pair arrays and that sort of thing, you can actually get directly out of the box with a smaller thing. There's no reason, I think you said, John, at the very beginning, there's no reason to keep these kinds of, you know, stuff that's in the junk drawer on these really expensive tier one arrays, right? So leverage something that's a little bit more scale out, a little bit more friendly for these type of large deployments like this to do that instead of those big arrays.
Under the hood, is this NFS you're using to present storage back to VMware?
Yes, it is. So basically we present I call it a V data store. It's a little virtual data store so we're object storage on the very foundation of everything. It's a custom NoSQL store that we built ourselves. So we'll abstract a little V data store, present that out via NFS and mount it to the ESX environment. If you want to move that back, it's just a data store, storage vMotion. That's all done via NFS. Yeah. Continuing along with this story, it's the cloning and the test dev is a lot of fun. We can spin that up live on our box, mount it to either your production VMware environment, your vCenter, or we can add a different vCenter. We call those sources. We can register as many sources as we want to in the system as far as vCenters go. And cloud, again, becomes just another extension of the policies that you build around your data protection. So you might have your local copies, you'll have your replicas offsite, but why not leverage the cloud for that really, really old data, stuff that's older than a year that is really just sitting there eating up capacity? Why not trade that out for an OPEX bill every month or a credit card bill every month? Really cheap and deep stuff on Glacier or Google Nearline, who we just got announced as a partner with. So really excited about what the cloud can do from just a pure capacity play to offload some of that from your hardware. And lastly, the biggest part of this to me and what really geeks me out is the ability to do analytics against all of this data. Now that we've consolidated everything, we've simplified the infrastructure, and we've applied some of the object storage fundamentals around it, we've got all this metadata for all these different workflows and jobs. We've got your file shares on there. We've got all your backups and your different workflows. Now we can do some really discrete analytics around it. So right out of the box, you're going to get, in your report section, you're going to get a drop-down box of all of these trending around data reduction, consumption reports, like by file, by user, by VM, by extension. All of that stuff is just out of the box for you.
So Pete, we will find your Disney movie collection.
You will find it, yeah. You will. I'm not letting that go. Get it?
Yeah, so no more turning on FRSM. You just literally drop down box, pick a report, and there's all your stuff on your data. You can find who's keeping all the MP3s in their home drives if you're hosting SMB shares right off the box.
Nice. That's awesome. I know you guys have your own file system that was written by a pretty famous developer that started another company, right?
Well, he's known for several different areas. His name's Mohit Aaron, and he was one of the lead architects for Google File System back in the early 2000s. The underlying layer that nobody ever hears about that actually runs all of the stuff that we know and love, right? Google Drive, Gmail, Google Plus, all of those services that we search, everything, AdWords, all that stuff runs on top of this Google File System, right? So Mohit learned some lessons there doing that. And then he left and he started this little company that we've all heard of called Nutanix. He and some other co-founders started it up there, but he was the CTO, co-founder and CTO over at Nutanix. And frankly, the hyperconvergence thing really was one of his big ideas.
Sure.
Back to like 2009, he was one of the big founders and just innovators around that idea of hyperconvergence. So second time, they got Nutanix. Nutanix is doing fine. Third time, he left and in 2013 started Cohesity. And basically, it was a vision to bring all of that, those benefits of scale out and hyperconvergence down to all of that stuff we were talking about that's at the bottom of the iceberg and do a pure consolidation play, much like for the same reasons we did for VMware with servers, you know, reduced costs, reduced overhead, yep. Simplicity, all of those reasons why we did VMware and other things since then. We're applying some of the same principles here. So why not take all of the things like quality of service, global deduplication, compression, encryption, all of these things that are table stakes for any storage vendor today,
yep,
and put them all into one distributed scale-out platform. That's really the Cohesity distributed file system. We know it as OASIS is our file system there.
I like OASIS as the file system name. It's just kind of calming, like what I really want when I'm talking about backups, rather than like super extreme awesome files. I don't know. Everyone seems like they're trying to take like a much more like, I don't know, 80s announcer voice, like at a, you know, at a at a drag racing show or something, and
Sunday.
Kids and old people not allowed at the Thunderdome. No, but it's you know, I loved your VMworld booth where, you know, that you had the little, you know, it was like a Hawaiian, like, you know, island. They're like, just chill, don't worry about it. Like, everything's gonna be all right. Like, it's
no, we love doing the kind of the. It was not a Hawaiian, but more of a tropical kind of relax. We had massages. We had the Mai Tais going. We had, or was it pina coladas? I'm not sure. I don't remember. But anyway, no, it's
clearly too many of them. Right. Clearly too many of them.
I actually got none. I was too busy running my mouth, as I'm known to do. But no, when we talk about things like global deduplication, one of the things I want to really call out here is one of the trick things that we do is we keep a copy of the metadata on the flashcards of every single node across the cluster, whether you've got 4 nodes or 100 nodes. What this means is that we've now got visibility, regardless of the ingest point, whether you're coming in for backups, whether you're writing a new document to your home drive, whatever that ingest point is, we're doing zero elimination, we're doing all that dedupe, all right there.
Globally
across the entire cluster, whether you've got 4 nodes or 100. Now, there's a lot of companies out there that'll go out and claim global deduplication, but most of the time they're tied to a specific construct within their operating system, like a volume or a particular node or something along those lines. But one of the things we're doing in addition is that metadata across all of the nodes in the cluster, and that really unlocks that for us.
Yeah, no, global dedupe requires a lot of resources, and that explains why you've got some really beefy horsepower there. I know with vSAM, we don't do it on purpose because we did not want to waste that much memory and CPU, although if it's a secondary platform, it's devoted to it by all means. It's, you know, obviously, and particularly for backups and targets like that, you'll see more efficiency. But I know that it's talking to our engineering, they're like, no, we're not going down that path, but for primary, but that's an interesting dividing line of having that for secondary.
Yeah, we've even put off things like erasure coding further down the roadmap because it's so robust that it's almost unnecessary. I mean, it would be a huge engineering effort and we could absolutely do it, but at the level of deduplication that we're doing both inline and post-process, is it a necessary thing? Are you going to get that much out of it for that large of an engineering effort to overhaul the file system? Not in our minds. So it is something we'll do eventually as far as erasure coding is going on, but maybe the more we get into, you know, flash devices and things like that. But we'll get there eventually. But global dedupe for now is pretty robust. You can even turn it off if you want to on a particular container. Think test dev things where you're just going to spin up and tear down a bunch of stuff.
Yep.
Don't waste the resources to dedupe that stuff because we're just going to kill it anyway, right?
Yeah, we've got like a similar design decision. We don't waste dedupe on the initial write buffer, and in our case. So, it's interesting seeing how the purpose of the storage drives the engineering decisions. And it's kind of funny in this industry in storage, a lot of people, it's almost like a religion. They're like, dedupe should be done this way. It should be variable block or it should be this kilobyte size or this, you know, and it really is driven by the use case. And it's interesting seeing a platform that was from the beginning designed, you know, to do this, the design decisions that were made that, you know, obviously seem to be working pretty well for you.
Yeah,
it's an excellent point. This is a totally different use case than what we look at traditionally with other HCI providers. This is not that. This is secondary storage, and it's really interesting to see the design decisions that have been made for that specifically. Global deduplication being a perfect example. So you guys have any play in cloud?
Yeah, actually, there's three main use cases that we're using, and they all kind of revolve around data protection or the longevity of maintaining long-term archival data in a certain way. So we have long-term archival in a sense where we will leverage the cloud as a tertiary kind of place where extremely old data will go to sit there and rest and until it is called upon again, you know, via some kind of recovery process. If you need to recover from 5 years ago or you're doing e-discovery of some sort, right? All of that stuff comes into play there. The second one is around automated tiering, which we'll go into that in just a second. And the third one is around remote replication, where we're going to be literally running OASIS in the cloud. So we'll be able to spin up a copy of OASIS in the AWS marketplace. You'll be able to just go in and buy X number of instances that you want to with your credit card number and use that as a sort of replication target.
Nice. So you've got a virtual instance of your primary OS sitting up in the cloud that someone can just order and then use it as a replication target?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really the goal, and that'll be available later this year for people to take advantage of, customers, maybe an additional licensing cost.
Though someone's going to ask you, it's good to hear that, because that's always a question I have in terms of these cloud gateway type products is how do you handle the making sure you've got, you know, the encryption end-to-end handled or WAN acceleration. There's a lot of stuff that it makes sense to have something as an OS. S3 is S3 is fundamentally, or, you know, these various object targets are fundamentally relatively dumb. It's just go throw some data there. But if you do spend a little bit of compute in the cloud, it looked like there could be some advantages in terms of either offloading, you know, indexing or crunching or things there, or making sure, you know, that the act doing checksum verifications, making sure the data in transport is verified. So that's really cool. You're going to have that in the marketplace just ready to go and make it really easy.
Yeah, so there's two real use cases here. From an archival perspective, we're literally taking a full text or a copy of the full text index and parking it right next to the data itself. So we have that extension via the search engine within the UI to tell users, hey, this data is in the cloud. Do you want to go get it back, right? And all of this is driven, and the encryption itself is driven by just policies that are built into the system. All of that is part of your data protection policy. So you can turn all of this stuff on, register your external target, and have all of the encryption, compression, all of that stuff transcend into the cloud. Not just, you know, once you move it off the box, everything's going to be encrypted.
This just seems way too simple.
It really is.
Intentionally.
And John, to your point about S3, this is where we start talking about S3. We call it cloud tier. And this is the ability for us to take and waterfall data yet another level based on age or last touch date, right? So if you have data that you don't want to, that by default it's anything older than 60 days once you register this. If it hasn't been touched in 60 days, we're going to behind the scenes shuttle it off to any registered external target, whether that's Google platform, Cloud Platform, Amazon Glacier or S3, and even Microsoft Azure Cloud that's coming, the stuff that's coming out with them.
Now, can you actually move between tiers within the clouds, like say from S3 to Glacier or equivalent?
I don't see why not. Any S3 compliant device can talk to any S3 compliant device. We're even internally talking about, you know, integration with CleverSafe. They're big on S3 as well. So if you want to stick to the private cloud but still do the same kind of processes, you can just register that CleverSafe device or any other S3 compliant device as an external target within our system, and it operates in the exact same way. So it's really about object storage and taking advantage of what that granularity of metadata can provide you, and identifying data that doesn't need to live on your actual array because people aren't touching it. And we're even looking at doing integrations in the future to alert users around, hey, that file is going to cost you about $180 to bring it back from the cloud. Are you sure? And kind of, you know, building those kinds of APIs into the system as well, because that's the first thing you hear people complain about when you move data in and out of the cloud is, holy crap, I just got a $10,000 bill from Amazon for this month.
Yeah, the Hotel California complex.
Oh, yeah. Like,
exactly. You can send that data there, but if you want to bring it back, it's
you can check in anytime.
You're right. But you can't never leave.
Well, listen, we're going to let you go. We know you got a lot of stuff to do. I know people can go to cohesity.com. That's easy. But how else can somebody figure out or test this or maybe even talk to you about it?
Yeah, I mean, the best place to do, if you want to learn more about what we're doing, we've got the YouTube channel chock full of demo videos. We've even got a 20-minute walkthrough with the UI with one of our rockstar SEs, Travis, going through all of the VMware data protection workflows, setting up policies, registering external cloud targets, all of that stuff there. The Tech Field Day, we have Storage Field Day 9 videos from last month, doing the exact same kind of demos and the presentations and the stuff we talked about today. And so the YouTube channel is a great resource that we steer people to all the time. If you're interested in POCing or talking to an account team, go to kcd.com and just put in a request, and we'll get that to the right sales team that will contact you.
Awesome. Nick Howell, Data Center Dude, man. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Pete.
All right. Yeah, Nick Howell, great guy. So if you're in the market for secondary storage, or if you want to learn more about it, as I mentioned, or as Nick mentioned, go ahead and check out his site. They've got some really cool demos. I've never seen it work for real. I mean, it looks really cool, and it looks really simple, too. So I'll definitely be checking out Oasis. I'm pretty excited about the cloud feature, too, the ability to actually use a virtual operating system in these different cloud solutions to do for replication targets. That seems pretty sexy.
You know, Pete, I think it's getting time to go crawl back up to the hotel room because it's been a long week and I'm done.
I hear you, man. I hear you. All right. Well, this is normally the time when I play our normal outro music, but since we're in Austin, I figured I'd do a little treat for you. We had some music. We went to this little beer garden called Bangers. Great, great country music band there that played, and so we're going to play you out with that. And so that country music tells me it's time to go. And if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. Subscribe to us on SoundCloud or iTunes by going to Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes of the podcast on vspeakingpodcast.com. Next week, I have no idea what we're going to be talking about because I am exhausted. And so until then, bye for now.
snapshots suck.
Oh, yeah.
Your Bush League.